I see us as co-founders of this country and needing to step into our responsibility to meet the current moment of what's needed. You wouldn't use the manual for the computer you had 20 years ago to try to fix the one you have today. So why would we use methodologies, approaches of 50 years ago to try to solve the complex issues today?
Hey everyone, it's Hildy, and this is the Creating the Future podcast. I'm glad you've joined us here today. This is a place for us to explore what really creates social change. Beyond the assumption that change is slow and incremental, what creates the kind of dramatic, transformational change that we can see and feel? That is the question driving this podcast. What will actually create the healthy, joyful world we all want to live in? I am so excited to share with you all my conversation with Yodit Mesfin-Johnson. Yodit's current role is CEO of Nonprofit Enterprise at Work, commonly known by its acronym, NEW, where her team provides support for social justice movements throughout Southeast Michigan. Whether at NEW or in the other roles that Yodit carries, including and especially that of being a mom to her teenage son, Yodit is an activist for social justice. She has spent her entire life working at the intersection of racial and economic justice for women and communities of color. When I talk with Yodit, it becomes even more clear the difference that each of us can make by changing the systems we encounter in our day-to-day lives. And so it is my joy to welcome Yodit to the podcast today. Welcome, Yodit. I always look forward to our conversations, and it's delightful to have you here today.
Thanks, Hildy. It's good to be with you as well.
Could you just share a little bit before we get into the meat about the journey that led you into a life of social change? Because clearly that's where you reside right now. What is it in your life that led to that?
Well, I think it's many things, but I would begin with my formative years, the daughter of an immigrant from Ethiopia that came to the States fleeing an authoritarian government there. His mom sent him on an education visa to the States. He met my mother, who was studying to become an educator and herself had been involved in the civil rights movement and had come to Detroit at the height of the rebellion there in 67. And they met and connected, and I sort of grew up in their wake, in the wake of their studies, there in the wake of their beliefs, in the wake of their commitments to community. And I grew up in Detroit. At the time, it was America's largest Black city. And it left an impression on me, Hildy. Namely, growing up in an environment where there was a multiplicity of Blackness that the city offered to me. I mean, everything. My school principals were Black women. The janitor was a Black person. My Girl Scout leader was a Black person. My dentist, my doctor. And it really imbued in me a sense of identity, a sense of belonging, a sense of connection to community. And I was drawn to a very passionate person. You know, a core belief of mine is justice. And I couldn't have defined that as a kid necessarily, but I think I always had a leaning towards what was just and what was fair and the courage to call it out when I saw it, beginning in, you know, eighth grade when I ran for school president because they set council president, because they said a girl couldn't do that. Try me. And won. Later in life, you know, did a lot of work around gender justice and working with women-owned enterprises and helping them to grow and scale their businesses. And as an entrepreneur, I think a lot of my orientation towards social change is born of my own experiences of being othered or having a lack of access to a resource or being told I couldn't do something because of an identity I hold, whether that was my gender, race, or ethnicity. And that culminated in where I'm at now, working in nonprofits for the last 20 years. And I think long enough to see the challenges of caring for community persist and actually worsen, and feeling real defining moment was 15 years ago when my son was born. And I think that just innate calling to make the world a better, safer, more loving, more just place for him. So it's a little bit of my story.
Being a parent changes a lot of everything.
It really does. And I think it's that future orientation as well. What will the world be like for him? Because I think we share that, those of us that are either parents or caregivers share that innate instinct to want to protect them and to want the best for them. And that's what's at the root of my work for social change, that my fellow human beings and my children and my family have a chance to live into the purpose of their life fully. Yeah.
You and I have spoken a lot about the topic of this podcast, the question of what actually creates true transformational change. And the last time we chatted, you talked about the importance of vision, the importance of values, and especially the importance of the mindset shift of no longer complying with oppressive systems. Since that conversation, a couple big things have happened. First of all, yes, there was an election, and I'm sure at some point that may or may not come up in our conversation here. But you took your son and spent a month in Eastern Africa, in Ethiopia and Kenya and Tanzania and Rwanda. Can you talk about that experience? Did it change how you think about the factors that lead to transformational change? Talk a little bit about that whole experience.
It was really powerful. This was my second time returning home to Ethiopia. I'd gone just over a decade ago for the first time. And I was there for the first time because of my family's affiliation with the former government. It had not been safe for me to travel once that government was overthrown. So a decade ago, I went. My grandmother, my paternal grandmother, lives in Ethiopia. She's 92. She'd only met my son on video. Never in person. And so when I was awarded the Eugene A. Miller Fellowship sabbatical, I knew that I wanted to bring my son home to Ethiopia to meet my grandmother, but also Hildy. I have been, since he's born, on a mission to expand his sense of who he is and the identities he holds by taking him outside of the U.S. context of Blackness and maleness.
Oh, great.
So transformative change for me is also very personal. It's not something we're doing out there. And it intersects with class and race and politics all the time. And I am not alone. I know that there are many people who take their children back to their homelands to reorient them to cultures that are often lost in the assimilation in the U.S. I also was going back to Ethiopia at this time because there had been a war and genocide that took place in the home state of my family in 2020 that ended about a year ago. And so this question of safety is a thread in my family and undergirds a lot of my organizing, which is about making sure folks are safe and taken care of. But I wanted to go back. Many of my family members refused to return because of the authoritarian regime that is ruling Ethiopia right now. And so let's talk a little bit about what it looked like to get there, because Ethiopia is changing. It is a beautiful, beautiful country of the 64 countries in Africa. an ancient country as well. I'll tell you in a minute about our Mecca to the northernmost part of Ethiopia, to a state called Aksum. But we arrived in Addis Ababa, and it had changed so much, Hildy, since even a decade ago when I was there. And what was transforming is that the current government really wants to increase its economic position through tourism. And so it's interesting, the Addis, the capital of Ethiopia, reminded me a lot of Detroit, in that when I was there 10 years ago, it very much presented like a developing country. In fact, I tell the story of it feeling like this juxtaposition between developed and developing. And one example of that is driving in the car with my dad. And he said, this was a decade ago, he said, oh, pull the side mirrors in and roll your window up. And I thought, oh, what's going on? Well, there was on the paved road that we were on with lots of traffic, there was a shepherd with sheep and a long horn steer coming down the road. That image is just forever stained in my memory. But when I arrived this time, there was none of that. There was what a family member of mine called this attempt at making Addis the Las Vegas of Ethiopia. So a lot of modernization, a lot of development, a lot of building. And while I have fundamental issues with the government and how it operates, I understand that part of transformation is about getting more people to buy in or to see your vision. And so this development effort is to grow their economic opportunity, but also to make this a destination place for tourism, which frankly is what a lot of poor countries have to do, especially countries that are carrying a lot of debt. And that is the case for Addis. So I was keenly aware of the difference between being in that downtown sort of town square area versus driving a couple of miles out where you would experience really deep levels of poverty and resource malnutrition. But I want to say, Hildy, because I think this is important, and it happened both times that I was there, my orientation around poverty, it pales in comparison to what folks in other places are experiencing.
Right.
And that is not to discount or diminish what poverty looks like here in the States, but it was at a scale, including within my own family, that I'd never experienced before. And yet, incredible amounts of joy. Folks really making a purposeful life with very little. Wow. And a lot of weaving and braiding of care for each other. So, for example, two family members have diabetes. A family member from the U.S. is sending diabetes medications. They are figuring out, right, among themselves how to make sure everybody's got their blood sugar regulated and everybody's cared for and somebody's checking. And, you know, somebody asked me to go check the expiration dates. This joy is very much connected to collective care.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to talk about transformative social change. Yes, it happens at the systems level, but it really begins in those relationships and in our connectedness to one another.
Right. There's so much in what you just shared, every little bit of it. Talk to me a little bit about how that's changing your thoughts about some of the work that you're doing. And because that whole piece of collective care, that's what your organization's always been about. So if you could talk a little bit about the work you do and talk about how collective care fits into that.
Yeah, thank you. I think leaders often bring their own mores and values into their work. And so you can imagine why collective care would be important to me because it's been such an important part of the making of who I am. Yeah. There's always been community. My parents later divorced, and there was a village of folks who wrapped themselves around my mom to take care of me. And even though they were divorced, there was still kinship and connection across our family. So when I would go to see dad for the summer, there was a village of aunties there caring for me. And not all of them were biological family. Right. So that is a part of my orientation. As far as my work at NU, so NU is a place-based intermediary serving much of Southeast Michigan. And we help organizations and people build power, build their leadership skills through fellowships. We help to nurture operational and organizational strength and excellence through the provision of back office services like IT and accounting mm-hmm. and fiscal sponsorship. We do a lot of consulting with organizations that are interested in disrupting traditional management paradigms and embracing new ways of leading and being. And we do think about our positional power as a place-based and intermediary and influence to try to shift the narrative of scarcity and competition and hopelessness and reactivity towards joy, towards nonprofit worker wellness, towards the importance of becoming a justice-centered sector and group of leaders. And we recognize that any work of change does require care, great care in the change process. But also, in my experience, when you want to have successful outcomes in any change management model, it's important to have buy-in, to care about the people who will be impacted by that. So that's kind of our ethos. That's what we're working towards. It's never a perfect science. But this past October, we hosted an inaugural social sector strategy symposium, mouthful. Wow. But the idea there was one of our core beliefs is that we're not only, you know, wagging our finger at the problems, but we're working together to build the, what we need, you know. And so this event featured lightning talks from folks like Trista Harris, who's a futurist, a nonprofit futurist and philanthropic futurist. We had a racial justice attorney from the ACLU because of all of the rollbacks on DEI that were already happening, but that we anticipate coming down the pike. We needed to talk about the impacts of inflation on nonprofit workers, their families, our sector. And if we want to engage in transformative change, we have to be clear about what the issues are. And so one that is pervasive in the sector is burnout. One that is pervasive in the sector is retaining good talent. And a lot of that is tied to not being able to compensate folks well and provide benefits so that they can care for themselves. And as inflation rises and cost of living increases, you know, we're going, nonprofits and their benefactors are going to experience the brunt of that. So we wanted to have a little future forward thinking. One of the speakers was a wonderful leader, Leslie Welch, who had worked in public health for a long time and just opened Detroit's first birthing center for women of color. And she also, talking about strategy and how we change, there are, at least when they started, there were 20 other birthing centers in the U.S. led by folks of color. And all of them were challenged with funding, with capacity, with strategy. And so Leslie and another a group of folks put together the Birth Center Equity Fund. And they are raising a watershed of resources to bring down to those what started as 20 and is now 50 at varying degrees of life cycle of birthing centers across America. And you want to talk about transformation and social change. You know, it was a both and approach, right? We want to build this one birth center, but if we really want to get at mother and baby mortality rates among Black and Brown women, then we need to scale this intervention in a way that can make it accessible across the country and not just in one place, right? So it was really exciting. So that was the essence of the summit, to give folks some very real examples and some learning opportunities around what a just and thriving future could look like. And then a series of what we call practice labs, Hildy, where folks like Jean Bell from Just Org Design or Rachel Zaffer, who's an abolitionist visionary, came and would introduce a concept and then have folks kind of practice that. So when you ask me about change, it is about practice as well.
I'm keying on your focus in the practice of disrupting management paradigms. And that's so much of what you're talking about in what you were talking about with the symposium. I mean, just thinking about things differently, that mindset shift. And I'm hearkening back to words that you frequently use, which is refusing to comply with oppressive systems. What does that look like when you pull that into, because so much of what we think of as, quote, the norm in management really comes out of oppressive systems and then oppresses. We wonder why people are burned out. They're working within systems that force them to burn out. What do you see when it comes to that?
Yeah, a couple of things. First is sometimes fish don't know they're wet. So I think the compliance is often, we haven't seen another way. At least for me, that was the case, right? It wasn't like I was going, oh yeah, I'm gonna hold tight to this thing that harms my staff or, you know, makes me ineffective in communicating with my board or, you know, that doesn't feel great about this relationship with philanthropy. That's just what it was. Right. And as I practiced and learned and sat with and explored what else is out there, I discovered, and not just I, you know, our team and folks that, so many people that have helped me grow and stretch as a leader. I do want to back up to the compliance piece in terms of management paradigms. The reality is the genesis of this country is European colonization. Yeah. And what came with European colonization came European management practices and styles. So you could take the quote unquote org chart of a plantation and lay it on top of the org chart of any company in America, not just nonprofits. That is the CEO or the planter. It's the next level, the overseers or the managers, and on down, right, to the workers. And because of the way our form of capitalism is set up, which was racialized capitalism, but also this intersection of race and class. So our system relies on a lower class, but because that system is based on the extraction and exploitation of the laborers in it. And so it doesn't matter if you're focused on nonprofit work like I am, or if you're in private industry or you're in the public sector, that is what we inherited. And so our invitation is to interrogate, does that system serve us today? And my belief is that it is inhumane. It does not value humanity. It values production, right, and it values product that helps to feed it. Now, that doesn't make capitalists bad or people who have, you know, wage disparities bad. It just means we are complying in a system that has led us to a significant amount of poverty in this country, a significant wage and wealth gap that cuts across race and gender and geography. It is no accident that white, lower class, working class men in the South voted for the Republican candidate because there was a promise of more economic prosperity that will not come, but it was a promise, right? And it is appealing to that pain point of I keep working hard. And this is not unique to that population of people. This is true for many Americans today. So I don't want my legacy to be complying in a system or perpetuating a system that extracts labor from the people who work with me and for me. It doesn't value them, and it does it all in the name of nonprofit goodness. I have cognitive dissonance around that. So I hope that answers your question.
It certainly starts to. I'm curious about some of the specifics when you're working with folks and you're looking to create that sort of mindset shift and then transformation in practice. Mm-hmm. What are some of the practices that you have been encouraging folks to take on? Some of the ways of rethinking the way that they structure their management?
Well, one approach that we have landed on and are practicing is something called sociocracy. Mm-hmm. And the roots of sociocracy are that it is a peer governance system rooted in consent-based decision-making. So I think we have to think about where is power and where is it being hoarded? Where is it being shared? And how can we be transparent about that? So when I think about my structure, yes, I am the CEO. We have a hierarchical structure, but I've created a way of governing and stewarding our work that makes more visible what decisions are my own, right? That only I'm going to make, and there are very few of them. But what are those decisions and what are those that others can make autonomously and without necessarily even needing me? And I didn't just do this because, you know, sharing power was the popular thing to do. It actually makes us a more strategic organization and a more nimble organization. So we don't have people bogged down in not being able to move their work forward or move parts of their work forward because they're waiting for some bureaucratic decision-making approval process that's just not necessary. So that's one thing, is thinking about how are we governing and stewarding our work. Some folks went towards true shared, like sharing co-leadership model. And we've seen those go well in some cases and not so well. But I do think the idea of distributing labor helps us to mitigate the burnout that is pervasive in this sector. So the African proverb that many hands make light work, I think can also help us minimize that single leader, lonely paradigm that exists for so many, that folks at the top of the organization, EDs, CEOs, leaders, often report a sense of loneliness and isolation, right? Yeah. And we want to push back on that. We don't want to burn our leaders out, especially not when we're really embracing diverse and expansive identities as folks who can be in leadership roles. So that's a couple of ways.
And what you're making me think about is again, it's the paradigm shift. It's the mindset shift. We are so steeped in the business mentality, the capitalist business mentality, that redundancy is waste. And when we look at, somebody made me aware of this years ago, and I just love the analogy, that when we look at the human body, we've got two kidneys. We got two kidneys because if one goes bad, you've got two nostrils. We've got two eyes. We need the stereo vision. We need both sides. We've got two ears. Why do we have two if what we really need is one? We're stuck in that mindset that to duplicate is wasteful. And we're not duplicating. That spirit of co-support is so important. And again, it's, you know, why do we have two kidneys? We have it because we need that resiliency.
Yeah. I also think, though, that leaders are expected to be generalist. And there is something about putting people in roles where they can go deep instead of wide, right? Yeah. So by leaning into the strengths of folks on our team, which includes being able to serve in cross-functional roles, yes, we're like bucking the status quo, but also, you know, this is about creativity, innovation, agility. It's not just like a reaction to something, but it is about what do we need today in order to have flourishing organizations. And one of the things that we need are new ways of governing ourselves that are undergirded in trust and in enablement and in autonomy. The other thing is that sector-wide, we have inherited a charity mindset that includes paying our people less because primarily because donors and philanthropy have an expectation that their money goes to programs. I don't want it to go over to overhead. And my assertion is I am running a business just like the for-profit business down the street. The only difference is where the profits go. And so I think that the people who invest in my organization, i.e. donors, want and expect for me to be able to deliver on the promise of my mission. And I need capable, qualified, well taken care of people on my team to do that. So another part of what we've been trying to influence is a shift from this notion that my business is any different than any other business, and that I don't need R&D money, and I don't need to hire the best folks on the team, and I don't need to have competitive benefits and wages to be able to attract them. And so I think that the disruption or the mindset shift is one from charity, that this is charity and we're just giving our like leftovers to the lesser than, to know this is the third sector, the third largest sector in this country. We are making significant impacts on the economy and on the care and well-being of citizens in our community. We have had a lot of what government would traditionally do pushed onto us. Right. And if that's the case, if we're going to, our industry is going to do government's job, then I want the money moving to this sector to do that. And I think anybody would want that, that is also investing in or donating to the sector.
Yeah. It is that complex interplay between class, between race, between history, between identity, pulling all of that together is really what community is all about. And it sounds very much like that's what you're rethinking in terms of organizational structures.
It's structure, but for me, it's about impact. I mean, I want to see a material change in the conditions of people who don't have enough in our community, whether that's enough housing or enough food or enough healthcare or enough education. I want to live into the value, the espoused values of this country, of freedom, of liberty, and what our framers and founders wanted, or at least the vision that they cast. And I see us as co-founders of this country and needing to step into our responsibility to meet the current moment of what's needed. And you wouldn't use the operating system manual for the computer you had 20 years ago to try to fix the one you have today. So why would we use methodologies, approaches, management paradigms of 50 years ago to try to solve the complex issues today? Right?
Amen. Yeah. Amen. In the final minutes that we've got together, Yodi, and I always love talking to you and I could talk to you for hours, can you just share something practical that you think you would really like our listeners to take from this conversation that they can start to run with right now?
Well, hopefully you heard some practical things.
I've heard lots of them.
Let me tell a story about being in Rwanda, because I really do think it's just a bold choice. So you mentioned we went to East Africa. We spent time in Ethiopia, then we went to Kenya and Tanzania. And by the way, you know, 12 days in the savanna of Kenya and adjacent to the Serengeti, where you're the little guy and there is a thousands, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of animals in an interconnected ecosystem. They completely rely on one another. And you see leadership at many levels. But what really took my breath away was arriving in Rwanda, which is the poorest and smallest country in Africa. And we came this year when they were commemorating the genocide that happened 30 years ago in 1994, where over nearly a million people were unalived in 100 days. And much like today, where we are turning our heads away from really serious geopolitical issues and genocide, that was the case 30 years ago with Rwanda. But I remember hearing about Rwanda from my mom and attending rallies and mobilizing resources to send. Well, Hildy, when we were planning the trip, my dad said, if you're that close to Rwanda, you have to go. And I said, why? And he said, well, first of all, today, 30 years later, Rwanda is the safest and cleanest country on the continent of Africa. And Paul Kagame, who is their president, and people have mixed views about Kagame, but after the ending of the genocide, he made some bold decisions. One is that no one in his country would be othered by ethnic identity. He said, we are one Rwanda. We will not refer to ourselves as Hutus or Tutsis or Tuas. We are one Rwanda. And because they had so few resources, he established a national holiday, Hildy. On the fourth Saturday of every month of the year in Rwanda, the entire country shuts down. And between 8 and 11 o'clock in the morning, if you are between the ages of 18 and 65, you are expected to do community service.
Wow.
That can be cleaning the roads. I saw an older woman pulling weeds from around the park. It is caring for others, you know, delivering any number of things that you could think. But the entire country for 3 hours on a Saturday morning shuts down to take care of each other. It blew my mind. The government, Rwanda has the largest number of cooperatives per capita than anywhere else on the continent. And the government is subsidizing the recovery of communities that were impacted during the genocide. And this includes their conservation efforts. So there were poachers who were killing protected animals, mostly for sustenance. Some of them, of course, as we know, for export and the like. Well, now the government says, in our efforts to conserve and protect our animals, we recognize that we need to make sure folks have sustenance. And so they supply, for example, a quantity of goats and then help this group of people, communities, neighbors, establish essentially like a goat collective. And so they breed them, they grow them, they herd them, the whole nine, right? I visited a women's center that was founded by 18 survivors of sexual assault and violence in Rwanda and during that time. And these women is essentially what we would call a social enterprise. They were teaching women how to sew, embroider, and create artifacts so that they could earn their own, you know, money. We visited a home where a woman taught us how to, this is one of their offerings, is you could go to like a class to learn how to cook Rwandan food. But that's another sort of stream of revenue and awareness raising. So as we close out and you say, what are practical things? I think people want us to give them like a playbook, but I want your listeners to hear that this is about a choice. It is a choice. We can choose to take one step and take the step that your organization is most ready to take. So that might be that y'all meet weekly to talk about the challenges of the sector. That was one of the things I did early on, is we would have a weekly dialogue about race and gender and the like, so that we could understand. Work on your values. You know, I beat that drum, Hildy, because those values tell us how to behave. They tell us how to be in relationship with each other. They tell us what and who we value, and they inform our behaviors and our decisions. So that's a practical thing that you can do. Bring someone in. Bring someone in. If you don't know what to do, my gosh, you know, visit new.org, call us up, or find folks like you, Hildy, and creating the future to listen and learn. There are many things, no one right thing. And the best thing we can do is take a step towards a future where everyone has a chance to live into their God-given and divine purpose.
You are such a gift in my life, Yodit, and I am just so grateful for you sharing your wisdom, your experience, your insights with our listeners today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me back, Hildy.
I'm so grateful to Yodit for sharing her observations and experience with us. From her travels throughout East Africa to her work reimagining the systems within nonprofits themselves, the thread that is so clear is the power of collective caring. I was so struck by the story she shared about Rwanda, where every last Saturday morning of every month, the whole country participates in a national day of community service. From that one example to the various ways we can be more attentive to our humanity within the work of social change, the thread is clear. Imagine if your work focused everyone's energy on caring for each other, not just through the programs you run, but as your way of being. Yodit reminds us that our power comes not just from those big national decisions like Rwanda's days of service, but in the small things we do every day. And all of that stems from being clear about our values, the things that are the most important to us as we do the work of social change. What is the talk we are vowing to walk? You can learn more about Yodit and the work she does at New at the podcast page for this episode. And of course, if this episode got you thinking, we hope you will subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find an archive of past episodes at our website at creatingthefuture.org. Thank you for being with us today and for wanting to create a better future for our world. We'll see you next time here at Creating the Future.